Thank you, guys, for the copy and the study.
Those are wonderful.
Thank you, have another one. I don't have to take from the room.
Are you ready? We stopped at attribution, but I'll give you a quick review. We're going to have a tape full of with eating and talking. I think we're all familiar with projections. The thing that gets complicated, she starts talking about on 87, is that like dream images, projections over time seem to fall into a pattern. So that they're not just random defense mechanisms a la psychoanalysis. There seems to be a teleology in them. So that you're what looks like one, you know, mistake after the other sometimes in retrospect, you go, my God, I went through those stages to get where I am. So that complicates the whole business of projection. And why she is now talking about the collective unconscious, because it is more than a personal process. There's some objective spirit at work. That's one of the reasons she talks about the collective unconscious, which is where we are now. The other reason is that whole groups of people can project, nations. Think of the Germans projecting on the Jews. So projection isn't just a personal process. It's a collective process as well, hence the collective unconscious. So we talked about how the archetype fits in here. I think you probably know all that stuff. We talked a little bit about the unus mundus, which we'll come back to. Namely, not only do these projections fall into some sort of order, but synchronicities seem to occur around them as well. Again, suggesting there's something much deeper than the intrapsychic personal stuff going on. We started then on attribution on 93. The question is, now we're back to the unconscious. Is everything in your dreams a part of you? Answer, of course, is no. How do you figure out what is and what isn't? It is not easy. It is one of the most difficult parts of this work. But one very typical manifestation would be when you have, let's say you're basically a decent person, and you have a very negative dream image. Remember, I don't know if it was here or elsewhere that she talked about, Jung talked about the guy who was engaged to a prostitute and didn't know it, and he kept dreaming of this sleazy woman. It wasn't his fiance, it was just a woman. And so it would have been wrong to say to him, well, what is your inner prostitute? The thing to say was, get away from that woman. So at times, we have to look at these images and the projections they may lead to as something that doesn't belong to you. And to take them as part of yourself would lead to either grandiose or, you know, the word guiltiose. Either way, that you are too puffed up or you're too demoralized. And both of those would be what she would call a false attribution. The other danger, of course, is if it is part of yourself and you don't take responsibility for it, that can lead to an inflation too. So she's just pointing out this is a real complicated mess. And be aware that sometimes you do need to take responsibility and sometimes you don't. You know, I think most of the people that come to analysis are, at least to this kind of work, you know, they're not egomaniacs. They wouldn't be here. So we probably see more guiltiose than grandiose situations where you're, let's say, in a relationship with somebody who is negative, or you're in an environment which is very negative, and then you feel very much down. And it's because you've interjected something that's been projected onto you, and then you take it as your own. So that's pretty much the purpose of 93. Is that okay?
Do you have a rule of thumb? I don't mean to between guilt and pseudo-guilt.
No rule of thumb, but it's a big question.
The right person might know the difference between what he or she is feeling.
For me, it's a feeling. Just pseudo-guilt, I just want to say, will you shut up? Where real guilt, one feels empathy. That's how I react, but again, it's not foolproof. I think pseudo-guilt, can I say this? Maybe, tends to be theatrical.
Would you call guilty of pseudo-guilt?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, definitely.
So there's something you can sense or smell as falseness.
Yeah. Oh, you know, oh, all the problems in the world are mine. Or I've caused all the problems in this relationship, or something like that. It's taking on too much negativity. You know, my daughter failed the test because I was in a bad mood this week. What I just heard. And then crippled with it.
That's a sort of an inflation.
You've heard my story about the paper in divinity school. Not everyone? That's a wonderful story.
I can't remember.
How guiltiose is an inflation? I wrote a paper for a professor in graduate school that I particularly liked, and it was a lousy paper.
And it was a lousy
paper.
Okay.
And I turned it in on Friday, and I worried all weekend, what's he going to think of me? And I saw him Monday on the quad. It was a very small school. And I said, hey, Dick, you know, I didn't write a very good paper. I've been worried all weekend what you'd think of me. He said, actually, Gary, I didn't think about you all weekend. So in our despair, we are so important. That's the inflation aspect of it. And that could be the guiltiose aspect of it. And guiltiose, I think genuine guilt leads to acts to change. But guiltiose doesn't. It's a real problem because we live in a time where guilt is like out of fashion. But it's incredibly important. I might distinguish between existential guilt and moral guilt. Like, moral guilt is, oh, I slept with this person, or I shoplifted a Mars bar or something like that. God really doesn't care if you shoplift a Mars bar. But existential guilt is when you are untrue to yourself. When you know you have a potential and you don't develop it. That, I think, one has to support. And people say, well, I didn't bring my dreams in this week because I got kind of busy and I feel bad about it. I say, good. I'm glad you feel bad about it. So that another helps or not, but
yeah,
it's a problem.
Yeah.
I think given the hedonistic tone of our time.
I guess within the inflation, there's like a germ of something that could be turned into responsibility, because it's at least it's an overblown sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
Maybe it's some sense of responsibility.
It can also be a defense, though. Mm-hmm. Well, if you notice, a word pops up, which is a link to the next chapter. Look in the middle of the page. Page 93. As we have already seen, a problem which even today remains completely open is that of whether evil demons in a person possessed are alien invaders or unconscious components which belong to the person's own psychology. So, we've been on the collective unconscious, and she's given us a foreshadowing of the next chapter, namely demons. And in that spirit of, do we see these images as a psychological phenomenon, or is there really such a thing as a demon? I think there is. I've told some of you about the story of my friends that had that apartment in Zurich. If you haven't heard, let me tell it again if you have heard it. Two guys had an apartment, and it was a three-bedroom apartment, and one of the guys would wake up regularly in the middle of the night in terror, sweating, and would have these horrible images in his dreams. And he said, I can't stand this. So the roommate said, well, let's switch rooms. They switched rooms. He started waking up in the middle of the night in terror. And so they said, well, this is weird, but let's make that the guest room. The first guest woke up in the middle of the night in terror.
Wow. My daughter was attacked like that in the middle of the night in an ancient house.
Well, so they asked the landlord, is there anything weird about that room? And he said, yes, the last tenant committed suicide in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think something exists. So again, she's just making the discussion more complicated so that we don't think it's a nice little black and white issue. There's the question whether psychologically the content you're projecting belongs to you or not. And then there's the question, let's call it a metaphysical, I don't like that word, but a metaphysical reality, some, you know, afterlife component entering in. And what she's going to do in the next chapter, she'll leave that question of whether it's metaphysically real or not, but we'll be looking at demons as images to help us understand more about the nature of projections, which are too big to deal with.
Gary, could you say that there's a third realm of, I guess, not really necessarily a demon such as that of a person that you didn't know that committed suicide and mm-hmm. stuck to a place, and one that is personal, but something that is inherited?
Yeah.
Or there are projections from your environment and those kind of things.
I think so, yeah.
And those sometimes can be evil.
I think so. Yeah. You know, you've got this whole theory that schizophrenia is purely biological. And they demonstrate that by showing how schizophrenia appears in a hereditary line in a family. And they then say that shows biology. It could just as well show the inheritance of a complex. Of some non-psychological nature.
Non-psychological?
Yeah.
I would say it would be psychological. It would be an interject that runs
well,
family.
I'll give you an example. I don't know how to categorize these things, but I think there are people for whom bad things just happen. In a way, you can't say, oh, you caused that. I think I've told you about that one woman I knew who was rear-ended in a car accident. And then, I don't know, months and months, maybe even years, of physical therapy to repair a broken neck. And on her final appointment to the doctor, she was rear-ended again and started the thing all over again, two broken necks. I mean, what? You can't say that she was driving irresponsibly or... So, when you see that sort of thing, normally we do these dumb things. You say, well, my dad did this and I did this. But I think there is such a thing of bad, whatever, karma or fate, where there's something else going on. Is that a psychological complex? Is that a psychoid complex because of the synchronicity? I don't know. But this gets...
Non-personal.
It's non-personal.
Non-personal.
Yeah.
But it's still psychic and a balance.
Von Franz says on 94 in the middle of that paragraph, one should never lose sight of the irrationality of human fate. Because there is that aspect.
Right.
And you can drive yourself crazy thinking.
Yeah.
Constantly trying to figure out how you caused that to happen.
Right. And see, that would be guilty of.
Yeah.
She did nothing, as far as I know, with the first accident, and certainly with the second, did nothing, wasn't in the wrong lane, you know, did nothing to... I have another friend who's gone through a very difficult time in a marriage, and was rear-ended by somebody texting. And the worst, I mean, why and when she was wrestling with, is this marriage going to survive or not, did that have to happen? So, yes, and we've all talked about that incident of the bullet, right? I think we've discussed that before.
The stairwell.
Stairwell, yeah.
You know, in the thing about evolution and how the next generation changes, their actual DNA changes, and that's a chemical thing.
Yeah.
So why couldn't you have a bad chemical?
I think you can, too, sure. Yeah. In that show on dogs, remember, I don't know if any of you saw that on PBS, within like three generations, the skull of a tamed fox will change to the shape of a dog. We all know about mutation, but that it could occur so fast is what struck me.
So is she saying with this, the story of the staircase, that there are some complexes that serve a positive purpose and we have to be very careful in dealing with them that we don't get rid of a complex that may serve something? How do you, I mean, that is so difficult. How do you possibly know? Especially when it's what appears to be an irrational fear of something.
I don't know. I think maybe... The general rule of thumb is respect resistances.
So if the person is really resistant changing.
Yeah, no, it could be they're resistant for the wrong reason. But still, I don't think you should try to force anything. I think that's the easy answer, at least. There was that wonderful line, which I've never forgotten in the Zarathustra seminars. I forget exactly in the complete context, but Nietzsche has a bad attitude about something. And then in the story, a woman appears. And Jung then interprets that woman as symbolizing Nietzsche's wrong attitude. And then in the next scene, that woman is pregnant. And Jung makes the comment, that wrongness is pregnant. So sometimes our wrong attitudes have a purpose to them and are in the process of birthing something. So to get rid of it would be a mistake. You'd rob somebody of their future. It's a mess down there. But these are all things at least to keep in one's mind. I think... if you can start with the idea, whether it's a resistance, be careful, then you are open to hearing what else the psyche might be saying about why the thing is so protected.
I think that draws out, too, that there's a fort, you know, the unconscious is not bound by time in the same way.
Right.
It can be a fort.
Right. Right.
Didn't Jung and von Franz, they both comment at times that kind of premonitions and dreams kind of happen more than you might think.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that does that chapter. And as you pointed out, Kathy, how much should we take as objective and how much should we take as personal is the question that it ends with. So what she's really doing, she's not making any statements. She's just trying to make us aware of how complicated this business is, that we don't forget about the questions. and then go to evil demons. This chapter, you could say, is now a development of the previous chapter, and she's looking at the parts of the collective unconscious that cannot be integrated, at least at the moment. Well, she starts off by saying, when working with projections, it's striking how we at times resist accepting the insight. And she talks a little bit more about that. These are just transitional comments. It can be apathy, top of 96. It can be mendacity, which I learned means lying. Or it can be the complex is so strong it cannot be integrated.
Or it can be unexplainable.
It could be. I think here...
She goes on to...
Well, no, I think what she's talking about now is complexes.
She's leaving demons aside.
Yeah, well, the metaphysical sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think what she's saying could easily apply to non-psychological demons. But she's just trying to get us aware of what we can't do with projections and why. And, you know, probably for most of us here, this isn't an issue. But for people who are, I've got a couple people who are just on the edge of losing it, then you can see the complex is so strong, there is just no way in hell you can get them to work on it. And the temptation can be to feel, well, they're just lazy, or they're just mendacious, but I think the purpose of this chapter is to make us aware what can't be done in the normal way, and so then what do you do? And if you look at much of, you know, what's being done in psychology with what they call borderlines, is all about getting them away from the complex. And we might actually have something to learn from them. But what she's trying to do is look at it from the traditional standpoint. Okay, the complex is so strong, now what? And that you're aware that you don't poke around. I remember once when I really first moved here, and I wasn't quite aware of what crazy really is. I was seeing a young guy who was just on the edge of insanity. And he was actually a very talented artist. And had a picture of a guy in a painting he drew. I said, well, why don't you try an act of imagination with that figure? Well, he did, and he became that figure. Oh. See what I mean? The thing just came in and took over. His parents talked him out of it and called me up, gave me an earful, which I deserved. I said, what are you doing? And I realized he can't dialogue with the unconscious in the way we talk about it, because the unconscious then took him over. He became that person. So this is what she's talking about. How do you work with somebody like that?
Or it says if they don't have a temenos, they don't have their...
Right. No temenos, no ego. they become whatever they feel. That's actually kind of dangerous. I think the kid actually did eventually get it together and went through college. But that made me aware, that's why you need to be careful.
They become what they feel.
Yeah, I mean, that voice said something to him and instilled certain feelings and points of view in him, and he became that. I don't remember what it was. I'd say it was a cowboy or something. I mean, he literally started acting like a cowboy. And he had to be taught, no, you're Joe Smith.
So it would be like Nietzsche being taken over by Zarathustra, in a way.
Yeah, although I think he might, yeah, at the end, when he wrote, he signed his letters Dionysus, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That really is a psycho. What do they call it?
Psychosis? Or what's the personality split?
Multiple personality.
Yeah. There's multiple personality. Schizophrenia would be a form of psychosis. Or multiple personality. Or what they call today borderline personality, which is you can talk him out of it pretty quick. I mean, they could say to him, damn it, you're not a cowboy, stop it. And he stopped it. If you say that to a psychotic, they'd say, well, where's my six-shooter? I'll show you I'm a cowboy. So it's a question of the fluidity. Yeah. So you could almost say this material is dealing with people who are in danger of being overwhelmed. And the worst case of that would be schizophrenia. But usually before schizophrenia starts, there's an in-between period. And if you can get in there and as we'll see, really sort of break every rule that we've ever talked about, don't listen to that voice. Kill that side of yourself. Maybe you can prevent the schizophrenia.
But then for other people to engage that part of their self in a healthy way, it could turn into a helper.
Oh, yeah. That's what we're trying to do.
Okay.
But it's when that thing is so strong and the ego is so weak that any attempt to do that is destructive.
And saying the ego is weak, is that the same as saying it's a boundary problem?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think they probably would always go together. A weak ego just means that the person is overpowered by some usually highly emotional state of mind. Sadness or rage or probably those two, I think. Or you can be kind of functional and still have a boundary problem. But there's a place where they overlap.
So basically what we're seeing is there's a whole gradation.
Yeah.
And what is right for one person, yeah, may be completely wrong for another. That's why you can't,
right,
say, okay, we have everybody that's crazy has this diagnosis and we treat them all the same. Yeah. It's just the way that, yeah, modern psychology, yeah, tends to do people.
And, we're getting into more of the practical aspect, but it is so complicated. I was going to say something. And what may be wrong for one person at a certain moment might be right for them later. It's a question of timing. And everything I've just said about borderline people, you know, I've seen cases where it doesn't apply, where you can do this work in a normal way. Don't ask me what the difference is. But you have to be aware that there is a difference.
Well, it's what Jung said about rocks, that, you know, if you have a whole bunch of,
yeah,
rocks with an average weight of 5.5 grams, you may never find one that's actually 0.5,
yeah,
grams. They're, that's the average.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the individual.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. For me, it makes the work interesting. And it's where it's an art. And what we're doing, we're just learning all the possible variations. And then we, the therapist, or the two people together, have got to figure out which one applies. And at what point, and how much, and so on. So what we'll be doing for the first couple of pages is looking at two fairy tales that she says show the nature of a complex that can't be dealt with in the normal union of opposites way. Does it make sense if I put it that way? We spend so much time in other classes talking about the transcendent function, blah, blah, blah. But here it doesn't work. So the fairy tale on the bottom of 96, just go a few lines above. The type of fairy tale could be called the magic flight. And I'll just summarize it for you. The king feeds a flea until it becomes as fat as a camel.
I think it's important to mention that the father doesn't really want to let the daughter go.
He's a strange dad to begin with.
Right.
Control.
Well, yes. I think there's, yeah, when we did Shadow and Evil, this one's in Shadow and Evil.
Uh-huh.
Fairy tales, she talked a little, kind of indicated that there was like an incestuous
mm-hmm.
relationship there with the father, on the father's part. So then that makes this div, this demon pop up. And the lack of the feminine.
Yes, indeed. So then the dad says, who can recognize what skin this is, gets my daughter. And a demon, a div, in the Turkish system, figures it out. And the girl then has to go off with this horrible monster. And then this fairy tale, The key image is that the woman escapes the danger by running away. You could almost say, in psychological language, by denial. And we generally don't give a positive value to denial. But here, it's important.
The magic course, is that whimsical, it doesn't always appear to help her. I mean, that's what really helped her make it possible to get away and keep him at bay.
Does it always come? I don't know. In the few cases I've seen this serious, it did come. One, in fact, I'm working with somebody now, listens to it. And the other one didn't. And the other one went crazy. Now, why does one listen and the other doesn't? I don't know. Certainly, what I think is normal psychological thinking, that the greater the childhood abuse, the less likely one is to make right decisions. But that has never been what I've seen. I
really?
Don't know. Never. No. The one who went crazy, yeah, there was problems in the family, no more than anybody else. Yes, the dad was kind of clinging to his daughter, but I've seen a lot more clinging, and the daughters were not psychotic. I don't know, but what she's dealing with here is that situation where a positive reaction can be found in the personality. And so what the task is to help the person follow that line and to stay away from situations which trigger the other one.
And going back to Shadow and Evil, she describes that div as the dark aspect of God. And that, you know, in pagan times, there were certain demons that they, all they could do was sacrifice to them. So she talks mm-hmm. about the throwing back of the,
yeah.
the comb and all of those things as a means of sacrificing to that thing that you can't encounter at the moment, in a way to, you know, keep it at bay for the time being until
yeah.
she grows some ego
right.
strength
right.
throughout the story.
Right.
And trusting her healthy instinct, which would be...
Sorry. Go ahead. But I think we have to take a look at the person that's happening to, and for lack of a better word, the temperament of the person. Are they more fragile than others? As you say, same thing can happen to two different people, and then they react differently. I think there's a good. That's a big
component.
It can be.
It's a big
mystery. The question I asked earlier, whether this could be something that comes in families, I synchronistically am also reading Shadow of Evil up here. So, yeah, I read both of these in terms of it. It really struck me that it was not the father or the daughter that was the demon, it was the relationship that came up. The particular relationship is one how they interacted. I thought that was really interesting. And I thought that's how these things pass in families, is certain bad characteristics of relationships cause demons.
That's interesting, because I was just thinking that, you know, how a parent handles the two, the terrible twos. I have a great niece now that's going to babysat for the other day. And it is challenging, I mean, because everything's no. But that separation and how the parent either squelches that or encourages it or allows it, and I think is a, as you think about the personality, you know, two, at two, we start building this ego that could mm-hmm. become a terminus, a house with boundaries. And if the child is not allowed to do that, boing. You know, I mean, there at age two, it starts having a profound effect of how the parent reacts to that. No, 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 no. And when you said that particular relationship between the father and the daughter called up the demon.
But you'll see families where some of the children do fine and some of them don't. You know, like both the same parents, but the relationships between mm-hmm. are different.
That happens at different times in the life.
And maybe some kids are not as sensitive to whatever the weird. You know, the parents have this little idiosyncrasy that for some kids they can handle it and some kids they can't.
Mm-hmm. That's the unknown factor.
The uniqueness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, are you all... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. The phrase in that second sentence about the king's peace of peace,
mm-hmm.
is that like an inflation?
You want to take a shot at it?
I wrote down what she said in Shadow and Evil about the flea. Let me see if I can find
it. It is a weird image, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, very weird.
And then the thing about the slippers, slippers represent a sexual thing, don't they?
You could.
What was the camel in Zara?
Exactly, that was the, because the thing with the camel, so it started out as a flea, something that's very parasitic and dependent, and then going to a camel, which is kind of more... you know, self-sustaining in a way. Mm-hmm. So you have to have the strength, I think, to go into the desert. I think was that it. Because there's mm-hmm. a sequence of things yeah, mm-hmm. there. The lion, the camel, or, the child was the last one, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the camel.
Lion, camel, and child, yeah.
Lion, camel. The strength to, like, break away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The strength to endure the mm-hmm. isolation in the desert. Mm-hmm. And then the strength to create something new.
Yeah, think she talks about the flea as what sucks the life from.
Yeah. I think what you said, I don't know what she said, but something like, the father encourages the dependence of the daughter until it gets so big that only somebody who can recognize it can deal with that girl. And often what can deal with an inflation is somebody else who's equally inflated. Mean people often get along by marrying somebody who's meaner. Sad but true.
She talked about the energy being blocked. It was making something that was small very, very large, and that's the complex that takes.
Mm-hmm. I'd be another way to look at it, yeah.
Well, and then it's interesting that the horse, throughout this, you call it small and little, so like it did take a lot. But it took. So are you all saying now that it was the one-sidedness of this that then provoked the demon to come forward in the dark side?
She doesn't say, but I think we could say. But the key, then, is what heals it. And what heals it is this magic horse. After she's fled from it. Practically speaking, such a woman might have to stay away from men for a while. Oh, I have one bad relationship after that. Well, then, stop going out with men until we can figure out what's going on.
It says right here... the daughter must therefore go off with him when she is seeking a horse for herself. I mean, for the way it's written, you don't know if she's seeking a horse for herself to go off with him, so she was being obedient at that
right.
Until the small magic horse is the one that really put her on a different track.
Or it could be, yeah, that actually by fleeing, her horse gets activated.
And then that ends up after she throws all of these things behind her. And then the larger story in Shadow and Eagle, they become certain things. Actually, it's not a clove, it's a flower that becomes, like in Sleeping Beauty, a thorn forest. I mean, all of these things transform into something else when she throws them behind. But she ends up in a place where she gets reparented by this loving couple, and that's really where the transition takes place. And then she meets the king, which is much more positive, masculine figure, and bears him children. But that still doesn't get rid of the evil thing. She has to continue to sacrifice, and what she has to then sacrifice to it is the little horse, which is quite interesting, I think, in this, and very odd in a story that an animal asks to be.
It's not that odd.
Really? Do you see that in dreams, that an animal asks to be destroyed?
Yes, and that is a real, speaking of rules of thumb, generally we should not harm animals in dreams unless they say, do this to me. In other words, that would be an example of the spirit in the instinct. That the instinct has a knowledge. I mean, it's not common, but it's also not unheard of.
So why does it ask to be sacrificed?
I don't know how to think about it that way. Let's suppose it's the energy that would allow her to escape. When she no longer needs to escape, she no longer needs that energy. Something like that, maybe.
Yeah, because then it grows into what she needs to stay.
Right.
That vegetative kind of spiritual growth.
But the thing I want to leave you with is how, in a crazy psyche, there is often a very sane voice. And that's what you're hoping to establish a relationship with.
And that's the magic horse.
And that's the magic horse. I just think of, actually, I've seen working with somebody now very much like that, where there is absolutely crazy. I mean, you hear this person's past, you think, well, why are you still alive? And then there are these excursions into paranoia. She'll just go off and do stupid things. harmful to her marriage, harmful to her children, not physically harmful, but with consequences. And then she'll say, you know, I was paranoid last week. I think, oh, thank God. There's a voice in there that can see what's going on. And where I've seen that before with the other person who did go crazy, that then would just fly off into more blaming. Why does one, and the person I'm talking to now has a horrible abusive background. The other had a middle class life. One hopes for that little bit of sanity. And then you got to be damn careful that you side with the sane and help them stand against the demons. Where our normal way of working is just the opposite. We side with the unconscious. We would side with the complex. Okay, what's this complex asking of you? Can't do that with these people. What the complex is asking is for her to kill herself, and she will.
So this is an instinct that helps the ego build up itself.
Yeah, exactly.
If we look at the horse as an aspect of the self, or...
Yeah, I would say that.
That it teaches her how to serve it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And then at the end of the story, because she has learned how to serve the little horse, she can now serve something greater, which is the garden that's created when he's torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's almost like taking the thinner process into the outer world, because to create a garden with little aspects of the self here and there,
mm-hmm.
which is what you hope for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, you got it, you think?
Because that brings up the fact that you have to have the ego strength built up to a certain point before you can serve yourself.
Absolutely. That's the background of all this chapter. And I don't want to give too many details, but I'm working with this situation right now. First of all, this individual has agreed to work with a psychiatrist, which is a big help. The other person wouldn't. And individual realizes she was quite high up in the power structure of a corporation. I can't handle the backstabbing that goes along with that position. So she quit her job. That's a sacrifice. And is now getting a training in a well-paying, but non-executive, non-competitive skilled craft. So there you can see the sacrifice.
So it's a transformation of energy, like you said, of the horse. From the need to escape, the need to stay. One was the transformation of energy from competition to creativity. Or
certainly productivity. Honest, working class, skilled productivity. Without the backbiting and, you know, the shenanigans that go on at the high corporate level.
Just to be worked with integrity.
Yeah, right.
So that horse, then, you're saying, is pregnant in the psyche. Is there potentially?
Mm-hmm.
In almost everybody.
I think in everybody. Now, why it is available to some and others, I don't know.
But in the borderline or close to insanity, it seems to maybe it manifests itself, if possible. There's more of a urgency, I guess you would say.
Well, I think it always manifests itself, but for some reason, some people just won't go along with it. That's the great mystery.
So you have to have an ego that's strong enough to stand up to the unrealistic demands of the self.
Yes.
But it's not so strong that it will not last.
Yeah.
And that's a...
It's a fine line.
There's a slippery slope on either side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
It's the
tightrope. Well, should we, since we're having such a light conversation, shall we have a little snack?
Sure.
We got through all of a page and a half.
We're slowing down to the red book level.
That's all right. It's okay with me.